Mark Schoensager here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Nothing was worse than the pandemic. There's just no question of that. I think a lot will ride on how what happens now and if we see how these habits continue. And if we see basically whether people are willing to re-engage with the physical world around them. I think what I've just been struck by is the level of extreme the level of withdrawal has been from your local community, from your local businesses, just the willingness to really kind of just pull back and batten down the hatches and let people bring stuff to you.
We have another awesome show for you all. We are speaking with Alec McGillis, a reporter at ProPublica, who's written Fulfillment, Winning, and Losing in One Click America. I joke with Alec at the start of the episode. If you look at the title and cover of the book, you'd assume this is all about Amazon. It's a story of how Amazon is doing this, how Amazon is doing that, and one could come away from that having a deeper understanding of Amazon's direct impact on the country. However, if you actually read the book, which I highly recommend, it's very clear that Alec is using Amazon as a specific lens of looking at the country in the year 2021. He talks about how he wrote this over the period of 3 years, and I'll read a quote which really sums up why this was important. Amazon was an ideal frame for understanding the country and what the country was becoming, given how many contemporary forces it represented and helped explain.
I loved talking with Alec. He's somebody who, like you said, Marshall, is really just bringing together the story of America through talking about Amazon. If you guys enjoyed books like Coming Apart or The Unwinding by George Packer, these are exactly the types of vignettes and stories that need to be told to convey larger socioeconomic changes and how they actually materially impact people's lives. Alec is somebody who's really passionate about bringing justice to poor people across America, about looking out for their interests. And he points out just some truly irreconcilable differences for the current Democratic Party, for the way that we talk about Amazon and the way that we talk about size and its impact on people. And it's just somebody who I wish more people would approach a discussion like this in such good faith, because that's why it was so awesome to talk with him.
And we prep for these shows, obviously, but I love it when we go in a direction that we didn't anticipate going. And that was definitely summed up around halfway through. We realized the entire conversation is a debate about the Democratic Party. It's on the one hand, Joe Biden and Joe Biden's appointment of Tim Wu and Lina Khan, people we are huge fans of, who are very much antitrust advocates coming from within the Democratic Party. At the same time, you have AOC and all the activism in Queens over Amazon's HQ2. But at the same time, you also have Jay Carney, the former press secretary of the Obama administration, going to work for Amazon itself. So there's this entire debate that really is going to play out in that context. And that's a great example of how this is about speaking about more than just Amazon and really about our country.
That's right. So this is the perfect time to say, if you guys want to help out Alec, make sure you go ahead and buy his book from our bookshop. There's a link in the show notes, link in our Substack. It's a great way to both help the show and critically an independent bookstore during the COVID-19 depression. It's something that we've been really seeing a lot of success with. We've been getting a lot of money for these independent bookstores. Once again, just go ahead and check out that bookshop. With that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Today's question is a perfect question to prepare for a conversation about Amazon. This is from Apple Podcasts. A quick reminder, the way you submit a question is you email us at realignmentpod@gmo.com or leave a question in a 5-star review on Apple. This question is from Adami24. Love the show and the multitude of topics discussed. My question is about the potential for new collective bargaining organizations in the private sector. Is there any chance for a resurgence of unions or Orrin Cass's idea in The Once and Future Worker of letting 1,000 organizations bloom, allowing the creation of co-ops or alternative means of bargaining? Thanks. Love the podcast.
It's a really interesting question. This is actually the perfect episode, because what we're talking here is about how Amazon very adeptly played politics, raising their minimum wage to $15 an hour, at the same time being a virulently anti-union company, which is why you see this huge clash going down right now in Bessemer, Alabama, where the unionization drive is occurring. I really don't know what the future looks like, and I see irreconcilable differences on both sides. For example, you see Republicans right now being like, these teachers' unions are out of control, they're preventing school reopenings. I think there's actually quite a bit to that. And at the same time, in summer, we saw how a lot of union discussion just completely erased the fact that police unions have been a long-standing part of the union coalition and one of the strongest parts of the labor movement. So, as usual with the theme of the show, it's become a real bit of a culture war, and I can't tell you what the future is. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, the thing that I also enjoy about this episode is we really focus on what are things that are structural and what are things and changes in our society that happened because individuals made specific choices? And what's difficult about unionization is that is an issue where there are these big structural factors that are making it incredibly hard to unionize in the first place. The nature of work changing, Amazon hiring a lot of contractors, Amazon using a lot of part-time people, people losing the capacity to organize or leverage their workplace power has been an issue that's been with us since the 1970s. There was actually a interesting review of Alec's book in the Wall Street Journal, and it specifically said that it's misleading to necessarily blame all of these factors or parts of our society on Amazon because they were going on in the 50s and 60s. They cited the fact that the peak of unionization was really in that 1950s mid-century period. So there's obviously something going on here. It's deeper than just Amazon Prime Day or the pandemic. There's all these things going together. But the interesting thing about these changes is that is what is providing the opportunity for the Orrin Cass idea of alternative arrangements, which aren't just trying to bring us back to the 1950s in ways that might not make sense in the current workforce of today. I really suggest people either check out our episodes with Orrin where we talk about this, or you go look at his work. We will put that out in our Substack this week on Friday. Oh, and I can't believe we didn't mention this until now. Huge thank you to everyone who joined our first Clubhouse show with Alex Kantrovitz. It's called The News. We're going to be back Thursday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We had a really great time. I love bringing people up and discussing with everyone, so definitely show up. And yes, we do get the comments. It is unfair that Clubhouse is not open to everyone right now. We are excited to be there when it eventually does, and we promise you there'll be lots of great stuff to come down the line.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it. Let's dive in.
All right, Alec McGillis, welcome to The Realignment.
Well, thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Alec.
You too.
Alec, this is one of the episodes where I am very happy that I actually read the book, because there's a world where this was a book that was literally just about Amazon. So we would have gone into the conversation. I would have quizzed you like you were Brad Stone, and you would have had to awkwardly point out that actually this is about more than Amazon. It's about the country. It's about what Amazon is telling us about the country and the way things are going. So let's just start there with a personal question. Sagar and I are millennials. During the 2000s, when we were becoming of political age, a lot of these conversations around these topics were focused on Walmart. So, and I think if you'd written this book back then, it would have been focused on Walmart. So what has really happened in our discourse that has made Amazon the best company or broader thing to focus on during this moment?
A couple things. I think for starters, there's the problem that I set out to write about in the book, you know, about regional inequality, the growing gaps between places in America has simply gotten a lot worse since we are talking about Walmart. I mean, Walmart is obviously a huge problem of its own and has caused all sorts of devastation around the country. But it was a different sort of different sort of regional geographic effect than what we're seeing with Amazon and the other tech giants. With Walmart, it was the hollowing out of the downtown, the main street, the local businesses, in that, you know, happening in the 70s, 80s, 90s. What has happened since, and that was very, you know, very much kind of tied to the decline of the American small town in a way. And that's a huge problem. And I one chapter of the book is really kind of focused on rural decline and rural isolation, in which Walmart played such a big role. But what's happened more recently in the last couple of decades, since we are sort of focused on Walmart, is this other sort of geographic effect, which is this growing gap between a set of sort of winner-take-all cities and left-behind cities and towns, small towns, but also good-sized cities that have really been left behind in the new kind of tech economy. And Amazon and the other tech giants are much more important in that story than Walmart, and because of the way that they have just come to dominate whole sectors of the economy, and thereby through that concentration of whole sectors of the economy have created a sort of regional concentration where more and more wealth and prosperity in the country is sort of sucked or hoovered into the places where these companies reside.
Yeah, I think one of the most fascinating parts of the book to me is that you tell it in vignettes. So it's not like a 20 or 50,000 foot view. It's very much actually like a 5 foot view of this is what it is like from the perspective of this person and how Amazon affected their life. Or more importantly, I think actually how their life was affected by these, you know, kind of multifaceted trends. Could you go into, this is frankly the part I found most fascinating, is about reassigning economic value to different middle American towns and more, and the structures of their economies where they used to be in transition through Walmartization, and now in kind of the final, I wouldn't call it the end state, but like their latest state of being, you know, the Amazon center or an Amazon services center.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we're seeing all around the country, and I chose a couple of places to focus on. At one point, I thought about having a whole bunch of different places. You're constantly moving from one place to another, and you know, it's where I would have added in maybe a couple other winter cities like San Francisco or New York, or Boston, or added in some more sort of warehouse places like the Inland Empire of Southern California, which is kind of warehouse ground zero. But I wanted to make it sort of hold together as a narrative and not be spread too thin. And so I ended up with really a small handful of places to focus on. And the main kind of like left behind cities that I chose to focus on were in Ohio and then Baltimore, where I live. And what you see in both those places is just that kind of shift that you just described, where you have a place like Dayton, Ohio, that truly was in its day kind of the Silicon Valley of its time, with just incredible innovations coming out of there, not just the Wright brothers, but all sorts of just really major.
The cash register, that was my favorite
one.
Yeah,
cash register, and then major automotive engineering innovations. So Dayton, you know, in like the 1890s has more patents per capita than anywhere in the country. And really just this font of innovation and ingenuity, and, you know, it kind of matures into a major manufacturing center, the biggest automotive city in the country after Detroit, just tons of assembly plants, but also more importantly, auto parts plants in the Dayton area. But then just gets crushed in the first decade of the century. You know, there had definitely been some decline before then, white flight, the usual story of depopulation, all that, flight to the suburbs. But the city didn't truly get crushed until the first decade of the century, following NAFTA, but more importantly, China being allowed into the WTO, which had such a disproportionate effect in certain manufacturing heavy communities like the Dayton area. So just incredible levels of job loss and population loss that come in the Bush years and then in the Great Recession. And so to the point where the city like this is now essentially become a logistics town. One thing the city still has going for it is that it's well located at the juncture of two major interstates, and 70 and 75, and it's almost become like something people boast about, like, oh, we're, you know, we're closer to the rest of the country than anywhere else in the country, that kind of thing. You know, you can get to anywhere in a day sort of from here. And
that you actually want to get to is the exact part.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the part that's left out sort of.
So you don't want to be in Dayton, but you definitely want to be in Chicago.
Right, we'll get you. Yeah, exactly. Well, we're just a hop, skip, and a jump. And so the city's now just has all sorts of, just a real sort of center of trucking and packaging and shipping and then the one industry that I focus on in this chapter, cardboard boxes. There's a big sort of cardboard, or as they, you know, like they prefer to call it corrugated.
I love that part. Professionals call it corrugated.
Right. Yeah. and I focus on a young man who's just, it's a really, you know, kind of heartbreaking, poignant story of a young man whose father had a small business, trucking business, a fleet of about 8 or 10 trucks that took auto parts up and down I-75, that corridor up to Detroit. But he lost his business to bankruptcy in the Great Recession. And his son has just struggled his whole life through a succession, incredible succession of low wage jobs. He's got a strong work ethic, but he's just never been able to make headway. And when I met him and his family, his girlfriend and their 3 young kids, they were living in a homeless shelter in Dayton after sort of a string of, you know, sort of downward mobility. They landed in the shelter while he was still working at a cardboard company, making 10 or 11 bucks an hour there. And he in the book kind of comes to embody the transformation of this one city from the one kind of work to the other kind of work.
Yeah.
I think what's fascinating about this, and I was thinking about this during the entirety of the book, was how much of this was inevitable, because you named in your previous answer the decision to enter the NAFTA, the decision to allow China into the WTO and then effectively not mind the shop afterwards. Those were public policy choices. At the same time, you have the fact that what the internet did is, to a certain degree, it ruined a lot of the geographic monopolies that the newspapers you refer to. For example, now when you're a local newspaper, you have to compete with Facebook and Google. And that could have been a myriad of different businesses that you also had to implicitly compete with Craigslist as well, too. So there are all these broader non-policy trends. So how do we separate the inevitable from the choices? Or, and I don't want to even say the outcome, but at least what challenges were caused by decisions that specific people made, and what challenges were basically going to happen the second that monopolies pre-internet went away?
I guess one way to think about it is that the internet happened and it was going to have all these effects, all sorts of effects on the media and otherwise, but we didn't have to allow the giants to get as big as they did. I mean, that was the real choice. That was that's where the choice that lies at the heart of the book, is that we have allowed ourselves to get back to a kind of Gilded Age level of concentration in a way that as all sorts of, you know, smart economists and other writers in the last couple of years have pointed out, was not inevitable and was the result of an actual decision, an actual shift in our politics over the last half century or so, to take a much more lax, kind of diffident approach to antitrust and monopoly. And so that's one basic set of, that was one set of decisions. That was one set of actual specific things you could point to that we, you know, as recently as the Obama administration, you know, just a really striking laxness when it came to not doing anything about this handful of companies getting ever larger and ever more powerful. And mm-hmm. One of the big questions now is whether Biden administration will take a different tack. The other set, though, of actual sort of things we can point to, and I think, and sort of hold people accountable for, is on the corporate side. And when I spoke to Amazon for the book, I spoke to them at length. Their basic line was, look, if it's not us doing this, it'd be someone else. Like, just, this is just, the world shifted online. Commerce has shifted to e-commerce. There was going to be someone like us that was going to be this dominant in this realm. And it just happens to be us. We happen to be called Amazon. there's something to that. Like there's, yes, there are these big structural forces in our economy and in our society that have given rise to a certain way of doing business. But there are very specific things they chose to do as a company that allowed them to become even more dominant, or that allowed the effects of their dominance to be even more deleterious to the country. You know, they didn't have to be as aggressive as they were in pursuing every possible tax avoidance gambit. They don't have to be as incredibly demanding in the way that they approach their workers and the productivity expectations in the warehouses. They could have put HQ2 somewhere in a part of the country that could have really used a boost, and that could have really in some way kind of broadened out prosperity in this country instead of putting it in the absolute richest city in the country. There are all these different things that they chose to do that could have been that where they could have, you know, chosen otherwise and left us with a somewhat less imbalanced sort of dystopian reality. I get a little frustrated when I think a lot of liberals these days have a tendency to, you know, smart liberals have a tendency to really like to sort of talk about everything being in terms of structural and systemic forces and sort of go to that level. Of course, you know, you always have to keep those in mind. But I think we often, there's a tendency to give short shrift to actual personal agency and personal choice and personal responsibility and let people off the hook.
Yeah. It was fascinating in your answer there, because that was going to be my follow-up. I'd be like, well, what specific, you know, things did they do that exacerbated it? And because I do think there was an inevitabilist part of this. And then mm-hmm. there was also, like you said, the discrete choices that Amazon made. I think HQ2 is such a fascinating part of all of this. So first of all, for people who are listening and who don't know, could you explain the HQ2 kind of saga, the bidding war system of Amazon and relocating its headquarters, how they ultimately decided on Washington, D.C., and what that on Crystal City, excuse me, outside of Washington, D.C., and what that explains about the Amazonification in terms of the geographical impact of their wealth concentration?
So Amazon decided that it needed a second headquarters. It had gotten so big in Seattle that it was really kind of just outgrowing the place with, you know, more and more, as the book describes, more and more just concerns about incredible congestion and housing affordability in Seattle, where there are now 45,000 people working for Amazon in the city. And it's just an astonishing growth there. So they decide they need to have a second headquarters somewhere else. They decide to turn it into this great sort of national sweepstakes, kind of a media spectacle of, you know, kind of a bachelor show type reality show process where cities can, you know, make bids for the second headquarters, and there'll be, you know, then a great hullabaloo around the process and the winner. They get 238 bids from around the country. And cities in town, cities just throwing themselves at Amazon's feet with just all these offers of billions of dollars in tax subsidies, tax incentives, painfully obsequious offers. You know, one suburb of Atlanta offers to rename itself Amazon, and I mean, just this, it just really throwing themselves at the company's feet. But there's meanwhile amidst all this, like, you know, this kind of grotesque spectacle, there is some kind of hope that the company is going to go somewhere that really needs it. That this in one fell swoop, that you could actually restore some kind of balance to our economic geography by having the company go to some left behind city or region of the country. So, you know, just imagine if it chooses for a second headquarters, a city like St. Louis, which just fallen so far from its prime, population loss as large as Detroit's, just this gorgeous city, one of my favorite cities in America, just so utterly underpopulated and just crying out for new investment and right in the middle of the country. But it becomes quickly clear that Amazon's not thinking in those terms. Its top 20 finalists for HQ2 do not include any of the cities that, you know, we would probably agree are on that list of cities that can most use the boost. So no St. Louis, no Detroit, no Cleveland, no Baltimore, no Milwaukee. I mean, on down the list. The few cities that were sort of middle American cities that did make the cut are the ones that have been, are sort of like the regional winners of, mm-hmm. you know, so Columbus made it, Nashville made it. And then, you know, comes time for the winners to be declared. And it's, lo and behold, it's the two all along most obvious candidates on the East Coast, you know, opposite coast from Seattle, DC and New York. And the New York selection kind of blows up because there's a backlash from the sort of the AOC New York progressive left over the very generous tax subsidies that New York dangled, gave to Amazon. But so we're left then with just Arlington, Virginia, Crystal City. And it's just incredible to think about this. I mean, these 25,000 jobs, high paid jobs, the billions in investment, capital investment for the new headquarters, going to the city that is metro area, that is home to five or six of the wealthiest 10 counties in America. The stated reason for this choice is human capital rationale, that
right.
Washington is home to this very, the most highly educated workforce in the country. All these people that are already working in the sort of like tech contractor universe that is spread out around Washington, fueled heavily by Homeland Security and counterterrorism spending since 9/11. So you have all those kind of people there already. And so that's the reason that Amazon gives for wanting to go to Washington. It's just like, that's where the people we need are. What is left unmentioned is that the other big reason for Amazon to go there is that Washington is the seat of the federal government, of power. And Amazon has now gotten to the point where it is so dominant that it really has more to fear from the federal government and possible intervention by the federal government than it does from other corporate rivals. And so it makes total sense to go to Washington to just build up its presence there, which is something it's actually been doing for some years now, even before it chose Washington for HQ2. Bezos bought the Washington Post. He bought this massive mansion in the city for $23 million in cash, which he's turning into sort of a salon. The company's vastly increased its lobbying spending in the city to the point where it's basically the biggest lobbying spender in town. So it's just become a huge presence. It's also just getting tons of cloud contracts, a lot of the government cloud contracts, though narrowly, you know, missed out on the big Pentagon one recently. So it's just has vastly increased its presence in Washington to a degree that's certainly not been reckoned with by the local newspaper, which would normally be, you know, in the prime spot to tell that story of a corporate takeover of Washington, D.C., but is now in a somewhat awkward position to tell that particular story.
Yeah.
Speaking of awkward positions, you have this really useful line from an analytical perspective about the nature of the Democratic Party, in that a huge portion of the party's base are the like persons of color, oftentimes who like work in an Amazon warehouse. At the same time, the people who are most in love with Amazon, the people who have most gone into it, are the Whole Foods, Washington Post reading, Prime receivers, who are the upper middle class part. Like, that's the Joe Biden coalition. That's what gives him the Democratic primary. At the same time, though, Tim Wu and Lina Khan are going to most likely serve in the Biden administration. So can you just, and you were saying this when you were talking about earlier about liberals, can you just talk about how all these tensions are playing out? Because it just seems there's all of these factors going into it, which are both on the one hand cynical, but on the other hand, if you're looking at Tim Wu and Lina Khan, I think to a certain degree should be optimistic.
Right. No, it's a fascinating dynamic that we have playing out now on the left. I mean, as you've said, that the core Amazon, I mean, Amazon is universal now, but the its core demographic is the middle class, upper middle class, blue metro area consumer. I mean, that's just that's what the sort of market demographics show. You know, Walmart is still stronger in sort of small town red America, but Amazon is strongest in the big blue metros. And I mean, there's a, that's why the all these apartment buildings in New York are now just overrun with packages and struggling with how to even deal with them. This wave of packages, that show up at these nice apartment buildings in the city, and they don't even know what to do with them. They pile up on the sidewalk and they flow outside the lockers in the lobby, and these doormen are just like, what do I do with these Amazon boxes? And my line in the book, which was one of the last lines I actually added to the book after Biden's election last fall, was that the Democrats have become essentially the Amazon coalition. It's the people who buy this stuff in great quantities, the upper middle class liberal urban consumer who buys the stuff, and then the people who package and deliver it to them, who in these cities are heavily black and brown, and that's an awkward coalition to maintain, and that coalition, the awkwardness has grown this past year because of the incredible alacrity with which these consumers embraced Amazon and expanded their Amazon habit. It's just, I've been kind of gobsmacked watching it, just how much my world of, I live in middle, upper middle class neighborhood in Baltimore, and how much my world has embraced the one click life and the reliance on low paid, low wage, mostly Black and Hispanic workers to deliver these things, all these needs to them. And
well, one quick follow-up on this, because speaking of the coalitions, one of the more forward-looking moves was the decision to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which, separate from whether or not that actually gets the job done for folks, that was very much a wet state, the Bernie AOC wing of things, or whatever we handle that. So you just really see this, I don't know, it's just fascinating, just all these, this, the real point is that not only is Amazon, a story of America, it's the story of the Democratic Party under Joe Biden and really, and Jay Carney going on to become, man, it's, I'm saying it out loud, but that's the point here.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so Amazon a couple years ago gave people a license to order from them and feel okay about it with $15 an hour. And then this past year, the public health experts gave people an even bigger license to start ordering, to go one click, to go completely one click with the stay home, bend the curve mantra. And so you didn't have to feel bad about it at all anymore. You were just doing what the experts said. You were flattening the curve. And so you saw this wholesale embrace of that whole, way of living, way of consuming. And again, you saw it especially in blue places. And so on the one hand, you have this huge growth of the company fueled by blue metro consumers. And then on the other hand, you have people within, people on the left who have grown increasingly concerned about the dominance and have been incisive in their analysis of the problem. And now are, in these few, the few examples you mentioned of Lina Khan and Tim Wu being brought into the fold by the Biden administration. And it's just, it's going to be so, so interesting to see how what is essentially a clash within the left between a sort of broader, democratic realm, liberal realm that is doesn't want to hear it. Like, right. Really just doesn't want to hear the problems with this, because they've grown ever more dependent on the company and its ilk. And then the small but influential critic cohort that is actually going to try to do something about this. Yeah. And this is all happening within the left.
It's so funny because, when you really sit back and think, like, you have to admire Bezos just from like a chutzpah perspective, where you're like, the dude buys the Washington Post before anybody is even really talking about tech. and media, resigns from the company when he's like the richest man in the world, enriched himself, or not resigned, steps down from the CEO position because he explicitly, I mean, I'm just speculating, didn't like getting dragged before Congress, doesn't want to be the public face. It's like Sundar Pichai, Larry Page, and Sergey Brin get to go like chase flying cars or whatever. Sundar has to go and appear before Congress. It's like in every single level, increasing the $15 minimum wage, and at the same time being virulently anti-union. It's like placating and playing off both sides of the left and making sure that he's always got hold on institutional power. I do want to pick up on something you said about one-click America and lockdowns giving permission to people in order to not feel bad about ordering from Amazon. I'm just curious what you mean by that. And because, I mean, obviously it's not a secret. And some of the more conspiratorial stuff that I have seen is, oh, like the lockdowns were really a ploy. I mean, Amazon's market cap has gone up by like, I don't even know how much. I think Bezos, you were telling me this morning, he made like $58 billion just this year. So yeah, go into that about the lockdowns, their specific impact both on Amazon, its balance sheet, exacerbating inequality in your view, and just more.
I mean, I had no idea when I started this book. I started this book 3 years ago was when I officially kind of launched the work on the book, and had no idea, of course, that the landscape that it, you know, was describing would just be intensified so much by the time I was actually publishing it. I mean, the numbers are, I don't think we've grappled at all with just how huge expansion of this company has been in the last year. And I think we haven't grappled with it partly because we all feel kind of implicated in it. I mean, 40% increase in sales year over year, starting from a very large base already. I mean, the company's grown so much in the last few years, but then you got 40% increase in sales over that, 500,000 more people hired, and not including the drivers who are all quote independent contractors, even though they all drive Amazon vans and wear Amazon jerseys. That's, I mean, there's such a massive need for additional workforce given the increase in sales. 50% additional warehouse space in just a year. And they were already everywhere. And now 50% more on top of that. Market stock up 86% or so, you know, year over year. But it's also something you just feel viscerally. You don't even need the numbers in a way. Like I was driving up to one of my younger son's baseball game just last Friday, just 20 miles north of Baltimore here. And it got really, really eerie how many trucks I saw just on that like sort of 20 mile stretch of I-95 going north of Baltimore. It was stunning. It was just, I describe a scene like that in the book from a year ago, but this was actually worse. Like it was even more chilling just how many trucks you saw. You see it, you know, you go jogging around on recycling day. My God, the box, like it's just.
Yeah.
Or just here on my block, again and again, as I was doing the book, there'd be these moments where like, as I clicked to send the book into my publisher, a van pulled up at that very moment. It's constant. And so there has been this embrace of consuming and this way of living that I, to a degree, have found kind of shocking. And to a degree that is actually, I would wager, is in excess of the public health recommendations. I mean, it has continued throughout. It has gotten bigger and bigger. It has continued even as, you know, even last summer when, you know, the numbers got much better and lower in a lot of places. It is just, and even to now when we're seeing, thankfully, numbers getting much better in a lot of places, it's just continued. And I would say it goes beyond what was strictly necessary for what the epidemiologists were urging us.
The thing which is difficult here is I'm trying to balance two competing instincts. One is the one where you viscerally describe the serious impacts of Amazon's growth, hyper growth, not just growth in terms of a business, but really specific strategy of growth. The very libertarian, like sort of center left neoliberal approach to these questions when it comes to responsibility to communities. But at the same time, especially during COVID, when things are finishing up, it's hard for me. I'm not accusing you of like minimizing like the serious human costs. I just have a harder time getting fired up about Amazon expansion like during this year is more what I'm saying. And I feel as if there are definitely going to be people in the audience who are very much of that. And honestly, like I'm of that variety, you know, the Whole Foods using Amazon Prime, where it's like, look, we didn't feel safe. We were wiping down our groceries back in March. And actually the Whole Foods in Logan Circle, we live in DC, that was actually clean and I actually trusted it. And it was actually a thing. It was packed. So how do we balance these two things? Because it feels as if the 1 year of the pandemic just really is this weird part of history where we didn't know what was going to happen. So can you just speak to that? It almost seems as if you're suggesting that what's worse than the pandemic is the fact that after the pandemic, Amazon will be much bigger than it was. And it's hard for me to agree emotionally with that reaction.
Nothing was worse than the pandemic. There's just no question of that. I think a lot will ride on how what happens now. And if we see how these habits continue, mm-hmm. and if we see basically whether people are willing to re-engage with the physical world around them. I mean, I think what I've just been struck by is how extreme the level of withdrawal has been from your local community, from your local businesses, just the willingness to really kind of just pull back and batten down the hatches and let people bring stuff to you. People making a lot less than you who have to go back to crowded houses with housing, with multi-generational families. And they're the ones who are out there exposing themselves in all sorts of ways while you're making the clicks to bring them to you and fulfill your needs. The wiping down the packages is actually a pretty good example that you cited. We learned pretty quickly that that was not, mm-hmm. that was not necessary. But yet we, even as we learned that certain things were maybe less, specific kind of situations were less, you know, of a risk than others, we continue to remain withdrawn and cautious and over and reliant on the delivery life to a degree that is just kind of striking. And that makes you wonder if it's actually now going to continue after the crisis.
Yeah. I want to pick up on that because I know we only have you for a limited period of time. Another thing that you're actually very well known for and actually ties perfectly into this is about schools. And you wrote about all of the children who, I mean, I wouldn't say we lost, but I think you might have titled it The Lost Children of the Remote School Year. And I think that's a perfect example of where we have, you know, this confluence of science and worshiping science, you know, which isn't actually scientific, becomes this cultural like shibboleth of people who are center left and upper middle class in particular, which leads to all sorts of like screwy public policy decisions. And, you know, you see San Francisco being like, maybe we're going to go remote school even next year, which the current teachers unions push as well. Just, I would love to hear from you exactly the same. I wouldn't call it contrarian, but like, I would say a much more reasoned approach to, listen, we stayed at home for a year and Amazon is now, you know, shit ton richer. And now we have had remote school for a year. What was the impact on that?
They're absolutely connected. I mean, there's a reason I've been kind of writing about both things at the same time. It's all linked. And it's a tough thing I have to talk about. I have to be careful how I talk about it. But something has happened in blue places this year, this past year, where there was simply a vastly different assessment of risk than in other parts of the country. It was so, you know, so striking to me that the second, the more recent piece I just did, I did two big pieces on the schools. One was based in Baltimore and focused more on the academic cost of the school closures, focused on an 11, 12-year-old boy in Baltimore who's really been struggling with remote learning. And then the other one more recently was about older kids and the sort of the emotional costs of the pandemic. And for that piece, I went down to New Mexico and Texas to tell the story of, you know, of a town on the New Mexico side that was really struggling, where the kids were really struggling because everything had been shut down. And then just to go across the border to the West Texas side, and where they had kept the schools open all the way up through high school, 5 days a week, to taking some measures, yes, such as, you know, contact tracing and masks in the hallways, and but they were still playing football, and they were trying to maintain some kind of normalcy there and not being denialist about it. They were just a different kind of assessment of the risk and sort of how to proceed. And it was just really striking to see it. And it was a classic case of polarization, you know, of a negative polarization. But it's just been really where people in blue places in America saw Trump being derelict and saw what they sort of thought in their mind was incredibly irresponsible behavior happening in sort of red places, and kind of polarized against all that into an extremely cautious stance where 3-year-olds are wearing masks and joggers are double masked, and you are ordering everything in if you can, and no way in heck can you open schools. That would just be beyond the pale, you know, risky. And it's been extraordinary thing to watch. And even as evidence has emerged on all these different fronts, including schools, that it can in fact be done. And then now we do end up with these stories sort of belatedly showing, you know, the sort of Florida stories showing COVID outcomes being not as disastrous as the sort of caricature of them it initially made it out to be. I do think there needs to be some reckoning in blue places about the approach that's been taken and how it came to that.
This is what's hard as we're closing, which is I'm not sure there is going to be a reckoning in the sense that huge blessing that the vaccination process is proceeding the way it's proceeding. Sagar and I aren't vaccinated. We're really pumped to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
DC's in this weird position on this, but because of the fact that that's going to happen, I think people are going to memory hole the past year. They're going to memory hole the past year, and it's just going to be a baked in reality that we had in a time of increasing just winner take all inequality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, a whole generation of kids who are going to be really harmed by this. So let's tie it up here. This isn't a policy book, so I don't want to ask you for solutions to things because that almost misses it. But I'm kind of bummed out right now, to be entirely honest. like seriously, you read the book, you listen to this conversation, and you really, my takeaway is actually to the specific set of problems you're diagnosing in America right now, there isn't a specific problem. You can break up, you could split off Amazon Web Services from the book division tomorrow, and literally, at least in terms of the really, really, really terrible things you're describing, from the opioid stuff to homelessness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that wouldn't change. So how should we just be thinking about these problems in a way that isn't going to lead us to, I would say, lackadaisical thinking or inevitabilism to circle it back to where we started?
So on the sort of policy front, I do think that breaking up the giants or somehow reining them in would have an actual substantive effect on this inequality, on this concentration. That's still a fight worth having. But more generally, short of that, I think one goal of the book really was just to make people aware of just how extreme the inequality has become, and just to make it more part of their picture of the country, and both to allow them to be more empathetic to people in sort of the other places, the other half, the outside of their own bubble. That's been a big part of my goal of my reporting these last few years. But then also just to understand better why things are the way in the place where they live. Like one specific example of this is that I'm always so confounded when the conversation about housing affordability in the winter cities is so just kind of locked in between the people arguing for building more supply versus rent control. That's like the whole intra-liberal fight in all these cities like DC and New York and Boston and San Francisco and Seattle. And what it misses is that one reason things have gotten so tough in your city and so unaffordable and so crazy is that there's so much damn wealth and prosperity concentrated there. And And meanwhile, just up the road in Baltimore, you know, it's the complete opposite problem. And we have people trying to afford $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 row houses in DC, while just up the road in Baltimore, we're knocking down houses by the hundreds and houses that, you know, look the same or even possibly nicer than the DC counterparts. And to get people to connect things and to see the bigger picture and to be able to have a more coherent sense of how we've gotten to where we are, to be able to sort of diagnose the problem. And the problem really is this incredible regional disparity that has made things off kilter for all of us. It just shows up in different ways in different places. And so if I can just, you know, if the book can just help people grasp that and understand better sort of why things are the way they live, where they live and why they are the way they are up the road, that in itself to me is a win.
Yeah. Alec, we appreciate you joining us so much. Seriously, it's an amazing read. It's fulfillment. It'll be available on our bookshop.org. You can also buy it on Amazon, I assume. Let's help him get his Amazon rankings up.
assume.
I don't know. Maybe they'll ban it, right? Yeah, that's what they're doing these days. You never have any idea. I've been reading your work for years, your piece, and I will put in the show notes, Revenge of the Forgotten Class. I read it the day after I believe that Trump was elected, and it really helped me process what was going on. So thank you. Keep up the great work. And we really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the great questions.
Yeah, hope you all enjoyed the episode. As we said up top, this is a great opportunity to go to our bookshop.org link at the bottom of the episode in the show notes. There you could buy Alec's book, support him as an author, you can help support the show, and most importantly, during this pandemic, you can help support local booksellers who are obviously struggling against the very forces that we described on this episode. Last reminder, we'll be back on Thursday, obviously, but also we will be bringing you the next installment of our weekly Clubhouse show, The News, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be back with Alex Kantrovich, great friend of the show. We're really excited to keep having these conversations, and we are pumped for more and more of you all to join the platform as we go further and further and further. A Realignment listener told me that he's heard rumors that Android will be coming onto the app, hopefully in the next month or so. So we hope to see those of you who are not part of the Apple crew with us soon. And last but not least, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting the show. See y'all next time.